people coming from a totalitarian regime. People in Iran don't trust one another either. Like, we have a saying, the walls have mice and the mice have ears. I compare our diaspora a lot to the Cuban diaspora. It's a diaspora that was created out of a revolution. There was no Iranian diaspora before 1979. We are now numbering close to 6 million people around the world. Everyone isn't out looking for a buck or a new life. Like, a lot of people are really just leaving for that basic, you know, we might find it cliche, but freedom. And a lot of them are Muslim. What the regime in Iran has done really effectively is make a huge population secular, and then also make a lot of Muslims not want to practice their religion within that framework that they've set up. It's such a failure of a project, the Islamic Republic. It's a failure in every respect. As a community, we are like any other diaspora community. I mean, you look at the Cubans, right? They're concentrated in Florida. They don't trust one another. Some people are vehemently anti-Castro. They've been living under sanctions exactly the same way the Iranian regime has, to no avail. It has not subdued Iran. It has not made them become less violent. It has not made them become less, you know, totalitarian against their own citizens. Sometimes I think it's important for us to look at ourselves within the scope of other communities and say, we're not that different. We are no different than any other diaspora who's gone through a very traumatic event.
The part that I still don't understand is, it makes sense to me why you would be afraid, if the walls have ears, to have a discussion about politics in Iran. Why would you be afraid of having a conversation like that here? What could the consequences be?
I get frustrated when people say I'm afraid, because a lot of it has to do with being a coward or a comprador. You know, you have business interests back home. I am quite outspoken against the regime. I have a lot of family members who live in the country. I have a lot of family members here who come and go. Nothing has ever happened to them. So I think a lot of people are either cowards or, as I said, they have other interests at heart.
Kaveh, do you have any thoughts on this?
I wouldn't phrase it that way. I mean, I really do wish more members of our community would display moral courage. I agree with that. But I don't think the risk is nothing. I mean, I think if you're going back and forth to visit elderly parents, for example, or if you've got a business, you've got a small business in Iran or something, I don't think it's unreasonable to worry about that. And that's something that people, just ordinary people, worry about, and it prevents them from coming out, from expressing their views, both with respect to Iran and also in Canadian politics and, you know, supporting politicians that may be against the Islamic regime. I mean, the more extreme cases of it, Samira mentioned, you know, the PS752 families. I work very closely with them. I'm one of their legal advisors. And they deal with real, genuine threats. I mean, you know, one of the main people that's involved in that organization, the Association of the Families, he's spoken up, and his family has actually been detained. His mother has been prevented from leaving the country. Other family members have actually been taken in for questioning. And people genuinely worry that, you know, this is a regime that doesn't care about its reputation, doesn't care what international human rights organizations say or foreign governments say. It will harm your family members for your activities here.
My understanding is that it's gotten worse. There was widespread protest, and we saw briefly, I thought that there was just like kind of a consensus in the diaspora community because of the sheer numbers of people who were showing up on the streets of Toronto after the regime murdered a woman, as you mentioned earlier, Samira. It seemed like there were global protests, and seemed like there wasn't a lot of controversy. People were taking to the streets against this regime. Those protests also took place in Iran, and people were in sort of civil disobedience of the enforcement of head coverings, things like that. And I'm reading now that the regime is cracking down. Samira, when you talk about cowardice, the regime, as I understand it, is a brutal regime and will crack down on people and take out vengeance on people's family. That's established fact, yes?
Yeah, but it's precarious, and that's why it's dangerous. You see, because you'd never know what you do that might make you get caught. That's the thing. And that's what really living in a totalitarian system is. You don't know where the red lines are. They can change from day to day. They can change because a certain individual doesn't like the way your jeans are rolled up or you're showing whatever. Like, Mahsa Amini was covered. We have to be very specific about that too. She was not wearing something that was out of the ordinary. It's just a certain person, a certain, you know, hijab enforcer said, you know what? I don't like this one. This is a problem. And yet there are other places in Tehran where you can walk showing your hair a lot more than Mahsa Amini was, and no one will say anything to you. Like, it's the precarity that makes it a problem, because a lot of people that I know personally come and go a lot from Iran. No problem, no issues. But what do? Their Instagram is private. Their Facebooks are private. Before they even go to Iran, they shut down all of their social media, so you can't even see them online. I mean, these are things that you do because you're afraid, right, when you step foot somewhere. A lot of people say, why don't you go to Iran to me? I mean, are you kidding me? There's no way I would go. Not because I think I'm on their, you know, list of like people to nab. It's because I don't know what might happen at this point, right? I did go back in 1999, but after I came back from that trip, I would never dare go now because I've written about the government, et cetera, et cetera. And they love dual nationals. We are used as little pawns in their hostage diplomacy. So it's the precarity that stays with people, I think. You never know what's going to happen.
That would only add to the terror, the randomness of it. I take your point that this is not some all-seeing eye of Sauron that will punish every infraction, but that makes it no less terrifying.
But there's one other point worth mentioning, which is that this kind of terror isn't exclusively happening in Iran. And when you say things have gotten worse, one of the ways in which they've gotten worse is that Iran, you know, for much of the 80s and maybe up until the mid-90s, used to carry out extraterritorial killings. That stopped for a while. It has resumed that policy now. So in the past few years, it has kidnapped people off foreign soil, or its plots to do so have been foiled. So for example, there's a very famous women's rights activist based in New York. The FBI revealed that she was going to be kidnapped and taken back to Iran. There have been similar plots against Iranian Canadians living here. So there's always that fear that it's not even just your family back in Iran, or it's not you traveling to Iran. Bad things could happen to you in this country.
I want to return to something that you said, Samir, which is that the diaspora is not that different than other diasporas. It sounds pretty specific, actually, in some ways, as I'm just getting familiar with it. But there are definitely some things that I connect to and feel familiar to me. And I've had conversations with other people, colleagues and friends, who are sharing, I think, the same basket of anxieties right now, simultaneously being afraid for friends and family overseas in a country that has been attacked and maybe drawn into further military conflict, while worrying about their well-being, worrying about what this conflict is going to mean for our communities here. We've seen a rise in anti-Semitic violence and intimidation, Islamophobic violence and intimidation, and I have to imagine that the Iranian diaspora is on tenterhooks. If Iran becomes a bigger player in this conflict, what is that going to mean for Iranians around the world? And then simultaneously, and I extend, you know, benefit of the doubt to pretty much everybody until they prove otherwise, that everybody is traumatized by just the sheer death count of innocents in these conflicts and the suffering of hostages, the suffering of Gazans. You know, to be kind of suffering from all of those things at the exact same time seems to be something that is a common thread where I can relate to Palestinian Canadians, Jewish Canadians, Lebanese Canadians, and I suppose now Iranian Canadians.
Everyone's on edge. Like, you know, particularly when you see two governments that are willing to bomb one another, use proxies all over the world to target one another. It's a shitty time. It's a shitty time to be from the region, I think, more than any other time. I lament the fact that people who are from either, you know, in the Jewish diaspora or Iranian diaspora get targeted because of what their governments do, right? We are not our governments. And I think that that is important. When we first moved to Canada in 1979 with my parents, my sister, cousins, and I were taken hostage. We were tied up to the back of our apartment building in North York because the Iranian government had taken Americans hostage. After school, the grade six boys in our school tied us up to the back of the building and kept saying, you took them hostage, we're going to take you hostage. And that has always stayed with me. The fact that, you know, you can be so far removed and try and get away from a government that you disdain, but the actions of that government will always reflect badly upon you. It doesn't matter what you do. People will see you as your government. And I think that that's a huge problem. And it's happening a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to my Jewish friends, they are not happy. They are not happy that what Israel does reflects on them. I think that that's a big problem. We saw it again when 9/11 happened. Muslims were targeted, systemically targeted,
yes,
and imprisoned, and it's a problem. It's not going to go away.
I want to conclude by talking about something that Amir actually brought up when I had a conversation with him about the possibility of having this conversation. And I think you mentioned something, Amir, about being less involved in diaspora politics and sort of leaving these things behind. It reminded me of something that Latvian Jewish Canadian novelist David Besmozgis wrote in the Globe and Mail shortly after October 7th. I'm going to read this. It'll take me a minute here. We fear each other, not the authorities. We've done it to ourselves. We have fled autocracies, dictatorships, and failed states to seek the safety of liberal democracies, where many different kinds of people are supposed to adopt democratic values and live together in peace. But when there is conflict far away, we behave as if we are there and not here. We replicate the hostility from hostile lands as if there is no other option. Yet we still live each day in another Canadian reality. I guess what I want to ask you is, just speaking personally, I've always felt a commonality amongst other grandchildren of immigrants or children of immigrants. I felt that we have more in common with each other than we have differences. What do I mean? My dad grew up in Winnipeg. He grew up in a neighborhood where Jews came to flee oppression in Europe, often from Ukrainians. So where do they choose to live in Winnipeg? They lived in the North End, a neighborhood that they shared with Ukrainians, who are also there because they were fleeing bad circumstances in Europe. And those communities pretty much got along okay. So the Canadian ideal, and I am talking about an ideal here, you know, something to aspire to, not necessarily the reality, but that Canadian ideal, as I've always understood it, is that when you come here, you leave old world conflicts behind so that we can live together peacefully in Canada. My question is that ideal dissolving?
Well, what a question. And what a beautiful quote you read out. Thank you for that. I don't think I would characterize it as dissolving because that would presuppose that it was there. I don't know that it's ever been there. I answer your question now being a couple things. Number one, an atheist. Number two, a citizen of Canada, the U.S., and Iran. And number three, somebody who views the world through really the lens of law, human rights law. And I find it unacceptable at any of those three levels to make it a centerpiece of our public life, what goes on in Israel, Palestine, or Iran as we sit here in Canada. I just don't think that's the centerpiece of our life. It shouldn't be. It's become so because of very strongly held feelings among members of all those communities and their proxies, Jews in Canada's proxies for Israel, if they appoint themselves such, Arabs in Canada's proxies for Palestine, if they appoint themselves such. It leads me to a place where I'm resentful, to be honest. I'm just quite resentful as a Canadian that these ethnic, religious identities imported from across the ocean consume so much of our public life and time.
Kaveh, as we were settling in, you and Samira informed me that prior to this conversation, you've just been having an argument on Twitter, which I'm no stranger to those arguments myself. One of the reasons why we're here is because I've just been noting a lot of Iranian Canadians that I know and follow on Twitter fighting with each other, deputizing themselves perhaps as proxies for conflicts around the world, and whatever kind of commonality or even just manners or civility seems to be disappearing in that conversation, the exact same as it's disappearing from pretty much every conversation I'm witnessing. What do you think about what Amir just said?
I don't know what it means to say that people are deputizing themselves to represent some other point of view. I mean, I can't speak for others. I'll just speak for myself. I am very involved in the human rights movement in Iran. But I don't think it's necessarily because I value my Iranian identity more than my Canadian one. I've spent most of my life living in this country. I see myself engaged in a battle for liberal democratic values globally. And I think where I can probably have the most impact is in my country of birth, where I speak the language, and where liberal democratic values have not taken hold because of a brutal theocratic regime. Does that mean that I'm sort of bringing old hatreds in the old country here? I don't think so. Like I said, I mean, I'm engaged in this global battle. And increasingly, I think the issue that I care about, liberal democratic values here in the West, is intersecting with the issues that I care about with respect to Iran. So just coming into this podcast studio today, from the library, I picked up Salman Rushdie's book, a new book about him getting stabbed. I think the Salman Rushdie case is a perfect example of, I want to live in a West where writers can write their points of view without having to live in hiding for decades and without getting stabbed at a literary festival. But Iran's regime, the regime that I'm fighting, is making that impossible here. So the fact that I'm engaged in that fight, I don't think it's bringing old hatreds or old acrimony to this country. I think it's just part of a global battle that we're having.
It's a contemporary battle. These are contemporary hatreds.
Absolutely.
Samira?
You know, I actually found what Amir said really interesting, because one of the things that I've noticed, particularly among the Iranian community, and I could only speak for the Iranian community, is that their politics in Canada is based on their politics vis-a-vis the Iranian government, meaning that they will vote based on who is hardest on the Iranian government, to the detriment sometimes of the country that they're actually living in. That to me is something that I think it's a problem.
Isn't that a good proxy or indicator of one's values on other issues, a politician's values on other issues?
Hell no.
I don't think so. I think that it actually is a problem when you live somewhere, but your politics are somewhere else, and you don't actually care how your politics are impacting the other people that you live among in your host country, in the country that gave you refuge. I think that's a huge problem.
Amir, Samira, and Kaveh, this has been fascinating, and I really appreciate having this conversation with the three of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. Listen, if you have ever wanted to make a podcast, or if you do make a podcast, or if you're an audio journalist or an audio artist, or I don't know, if you've ever heard a podcast and thought, maybe I can do that, I want to remind you that we have our first ever audio contest open. The deadline is May 31st. We're looking for 3-minute pieces about where you live. You'll find the details for this at candleland.com/audio contest. There are cash prizes, and we will play your work to an audience of thousands and thousands of people. And this is also a way that we are going to meet a lot of aspiring audio producers. Check this out. Tell a friend, candleland.com/audio contest. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson, audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Andre Prue is our production manager. Karen Pugliese is our editor-in-chief. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Karen K. Ho, senior staff writer at Art News, one-time Pokemon Go correspondent for the Globe and Mail, and popularizer of the term doomscrolling, who once got under the skin of Bob Woodward by asking a very pointed question. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks so much.
Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. So in this show, Karen, we like to duly note things. Today, I would like to note duly that, as listeners may remember, in late summer 2021, Candleland released a 5-part podcast series called The White Saviors, which looked at We Charity and its founders, Craig and Mark Kielberger, tracing the history of the organization from its earliest days in the mid-1990s through the events that led to the abrupt winding down of its Canadian operations 25 years later. As some of you may also know, Teresa Kielberger, the mother of Craig and Mark, launched a lawsuit against Candleland in October of 2021, relating to certain statements in the show's first episode. In addition to Candleland the company, the suit named several people who were credited on the episode and or worked at Candleland, including myself, as well as Isabel Vincent, a reporter who was among the interviewees. What fewer of you likely know is that last fall, the Candleland defendants and Isabel Vincent filed parallel motions to dismiss the lawsuit pursuant to Section 137.1 of the Courts of Justice Act, commonly called the SLAP or anti-SLAP provisions, which are intended to, quote, discourage the use of litigation as a means of unduly limiting expression on matters of public interest, end quote. As is to be expected, Teresa Kielberger opposes the motions, asserting that they have no merit. I'd like to duly note that the matter was heard in court on Tuesday at the very lovely Osgoode Hall, where our respective lawyers delivered oral arguments before Superior Court Justice Edward Morgan. At the end, Justice Morgan said he doesn't have a long queue of reserves, meaning that there aren't too many matters he has to get to before this one, and so he hopes to rule on it fairly soon. So I'd just like to duly note that this motion was in court, and there will be a decision on it soon, and also that Osgoode has perhaps the most remarkable interiors of any public building in Toronto, and that if you live in the city and have never done so, you should probably just pop in one day to walk around.
Duly noted.
Karen, what would you like to note duly today?
I'd like to note the work of Connie Walker and her amazing podcast, Stolen, which recently had its third season debut.
Oh, wow. Where did it end up being picked up?
So it hasn't been picked up. That's the problem.
Ah.
Gimlet is obligated to release its latest season, and they are searching desperately for a new home, despite the fact that it has won, you know, every prestigious award that you can think of.
Yeah, well, she won the Pulitzer and the Peabody within days of each other last year, and yes, she was just on the Time 100 Most Influential People list. That's extraordinary, and yet, yeah, she was laid off from Gimlet recently, wasn't she?
She was, and then another thing that really strikes me is that despite all this growing attention on her work and how it serves as a really good counterexample to true crime, right, in terms of its nuance, in terms of how it talks about systemic issues, both in Canada and the United States regarding, like, what, you know, I think a lot of this mistreatment and devastation in Indigenous communities, both not just among missing and murdered Indigenous women, but also the men communities that were put in residential school. There has never been a public apology from the CBC in regards to how they treated her, right? Like, there was an amazing profile earlier this year in The Walrus that was almost like New Yorker style in terms of how comprehensively it chronicled her career. And it details like the way that she was treated at the CBC. And like, I really think it's an amazing illustration of like how brain drain happens in Canadian media, like what pushes really brilliant people to leave the country and its ecosystem or places like the CBC to leave journalism or to leave the country. And then, you know, in terms of the lack of accountability.
Yeah, and while she was back in Canada last September, we actually recorded an interview with her about all of that, and we'll link to it in the show notes.
The people who did that to Connie Walker, a future award-winning podcaster and broadcaster and journalist in general. Like, I grew up watching her on Street Sets. I remember this.
Yeah, me too.
I'd be curious, like, if a public editor or someone internally tried to do this, you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things that I think about all the time.
I'd be curious if there was a private apology. I mean, I don't know if it's a private apology. I guess it's not necessarily my business to know. But I mean, even setting aside from the public apology, I wonder if anyone has apologized to her privately.
Well, even if it was private. So the thing about it is, if there was a private apology, then I think it's more harmful. Because the problem is, like, it's the public broadcaster. And then on top of that, it's almost like the burden is on Connie to know that there was internal admission of fault, but there would be never public admission, right? Like it would be more meaningful if it was public, because then there would be an impetus for them to like improve and treat their staff differently going forward, like in a similar case. If the concern is that like someone in a similar position will use it for like salary negotiations or promotion negotiations going forward, then that's also antithetical to all of the organization's promises to do better on diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I think fundamentally the thing about it is that show is such a beacon of excellence. And like I said, like an example of true crime, its evolution and its inclusion, but there aren't resources in our immediate entertainment system.
Yeah, not even for the most decorated awards-wise podcaster of, I wouldn't say of our time, but like of currently, presently, one of the very few people to win a Pulitzer for podcasting. I think only the second. Duly noted. That's Shortcuts this week. Thank you so much for joining me, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
People can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com, where they can complain about how fast I speak, or they can follow me on Blue Sky. Karen, where can people find you?
They can find me also on Blue Sky. I am on Instagram. It's mostly pictures of my dog, Max, as well as they can read my reporting at artnews.com.
Cool. And Karen, I understand you're donating the honorarium associated with this Shortcuts?
Sure. I have chosen Nana Abba Duncan, who's the Carty Chair in Journalism, Diversity, and Inclusion at Carleton University, has started the Mary Ann Chad Carey Center for Journalism and Belonging.
Oh, wow.
And she was the first Black woman newspaper publisher in North America and the first woman publisher in Canada. And so she has a fellowship specially for Black journalists to go to the National Association of Black Journalists Convention and Career Fair in Chicago. And having been a Canadian journalist trying to attend American conferences, the expense, especially with the exchange rate, is something I'm hyper aware of. And I know firsthand how much of a difference it can feel for your career to go to those American networking events and like meet other people in the industry that can relate to a lot of your own experiences. And so that's where I'm donating.
That's wonderful. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. The music is by So-Called, syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Cego.
Buju Anin.
Danacha at Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tonse.
Ay, Inuhadikai.
Words and culture weaves conversations with indigenous language and knowledge keepers to learn, celebrate, and connect. Join us as we delve into distinct indigenous language families, beginning in February.